Hello and welcome to the House of Inner Tranquility podcast. My name is Steve Hemmingsley and I'm a student here at the House of Inner Tranquility. And I'm here with Paul Harris, who's the spiritual director and principal teacher at the Meditation Center. Together, we're going to talk about meditation and the Buddha's teaching in general. So something that sort of came up in my mind today, and it was sort of in between the meditation sessions where we sort of had the opportunity to pick a book and do some reading, was this idea of the learning about meditation versus the actual hands-on practice of doing it. Uh-huh. And then reflecting myself on, say, the last maybe 12 months that I've got more and more into meditation, the urge to want to sort of learn and read more about it and balance that with actually directly meditating. And I sort of wonder whether there's a element of my mind that's wanting to, and this is what came up when I was reflecting, is there an element of my mind that's wanting to just find another aspect to attach to? And where my focus is now more on meditation rather than, I guess, maybe some more materialistic things or certain experiences, is my mind finding a sort of back route into attaching now to either meditation itself, but more prominently the idea of the knowledge associated to it. And then I sort of got myself in a bit of a muddle, because it's sort of like, if I don't have a certain amount of knowledge, I won't be able to fully get into it. But then there's a risk of knowing what's the balance between learning about something enough to be able to do it, or then getting attached to just the knowledge side of it, if that makes sense. I wonder if that's a common sort of situation that arises.
Oh, it is. It is. Because often our intellectual understanding of something races ahead of our direct experience of it. We need the descriptions. We need to know. We need to have some sense of where we're going. Mm-hmm. Even though, ideally, with meditation, it is resting content in the unknowable nature of the moment, allowing whatever wants to arise. So we're in that very uncertain place. We want that kind of. It's not naivety. It's not innocence. There's another word for it. It's just being very open and receptive and interested in what unfolds, without having an agenda. That's what we want when we meditate. But by the same token, we need to know why that's what we need to do. So there has to be a certain element of intellectual, philosophical side to it. But you don't want to be dominated by the intellectual side. Mm-hmm. The intellectual side really wants to be a support for direct apprehension and comprehension through meditation. So you need some kind of map, mm-hmm. but you don't want to be overrun by map knowledge. Map knowledge isn't going to set anyone free. You need the direct experience of actually being there and doing it. And then, so you're starting from a position of, again, it's not innocence. I can't think of the right word for it. But it's that place of just openness, receptiveness, not knowingness. Mm-hmm. Which is why you need faith. And then you see things and recognize what the books have been telling you.
Okay.
So you get that acknowledgement. Mm-hmm. But what is most important is the direct experience. And then, say for instance, it's like a hindrance.
Yeah.
And you've been battling away with the hindrance. You've been reading about this particular hindrance, say it's worry. Mm-hmm. And then at some point in the meditation, there's a moment of acknowledgement. Oh, this is worry. And then you refer to your intellectual book reading side of the knowledge, which says, oh, and here are some of the things you can do to overcome worry in the moment. You know, so it supports the practice, but it doesn't dominate it.
It's
led by the direct experience.
So the leading is on the direct side, and actually through that direct practice you can then notice and recognize some of the things that you've read about that give you that sort of framework or that map, but you're not living through the map, you're living through the reality of direct experience, noticing pieces from the map as they arrive in direct experience. Maybe. Yes. Makes sense.
Perfectly put. Yeah, it's exactly what it is.
Okay.
And there's another aspect to it, which is there is a buzz that comes with that recognition. There's this upwelling of confidence and faith in what you're doing, because now you see what had foxed you when reading the books is now like obvious.
Yeah.
Because you're actually seeing it.
Yeah.
And that makes for then a far more profound and interesting meditation.
And I guess is it those types of experiences where things start to make sense and click into place that then gives you, I don't know whether motivation's the right word to use, but that, or even desire, but something along those lines to continue along the path further and further in terms of more direct experience and more understanding.
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely. Well, there are two aspects to that. What it is that motivates someone to persist. Because I'm sure you're aware by now that meditation isn't always bliss, to say the least. It's really hard. It's like you're having to face the reality of your self-centeredness and hindrances and unskillfulness, and that's very challenging and very difficult. So what is it that causes someone to persist? Well, on the one hand, yes, it's definitely getting feedback through the practice directly that actually the Buddha's teaching is a description of reality. It's not made up.
Mm-hmm.
That's very, you know, that does wonders for your faith when you realize that. And in that you sort of cast forward what that means in terms of realizing freedom from suffering. And you think, oh, wow. Well, if this bit's true, what's to say the other bits are true as well?
Yeah, yeah.
And if you've got that connection that, well, that is true because I know and see it in my experience to be so, that does wonders for your motivation. And the other thing that does wonders for the motivation is looking back in hindsight, looking back over meditation journals since you started, looking back at how your understanding has grown in the meantime,
mm-hmm.
and also looking at, well, have levels of suffering increased or decreased, or have you at least become more aware of suffering and the real causes of it through this practice? So it's looking back in hindsight at the past and seeing how you've developed, because you can't really assess development on a meditation by meditation basis, because mm-hmm. you know there are peaks and troughs, there are points at which you advance and then you seem to go back two or three steps and then you advance again back to that place and it becomes mm-hmm. more steady and
yeah
secure. But over a long period of time, like months and years,
yeah
you do start, you look back and you go, oh no, there's been a huge transformation since I started meditating, you know.
And when you reflect back to those periods, say even months or years ago, is a recognition that even things at the time that maybe you couldn't make sense of or felt like suffering were completely necessary as part of the journey to get you to where you've got to? Or are there still cases where you look back and think, well, that wasn't necessary, or things could have been different? Or is there just that acceptance that everything had to be that way and was perfectly correct to be that way to get you to where you got to now, if that makes sense?
That's a deep question, actually.
Yeah.
Because it's about fate and whether you could have done things differently. And one of the many things I love about the Buddha's teaching is that it's a middle way.
Yeah.
It's neither saying that it's saying that had mindfulness and clear comprehension been with you when you were in that situation,
mm-hmm.
you might well have chosen differently.
Yeah.
But given that there was no mindfulness and there was no clear comprehension, it was inevitable that you performed that action, and these are the results.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, looking at it with the benefit of hindsight couched in the Buddha's teaching, it's possible to see that, yes, maybe if the circumstances had been different, I would have made a different choice. However, I didn't. These are the results that I'm experiencing now. But what I can do is just make a mental note to say, well, given the same or similar circumstances in the future,
yeah,
maybe my choice can adapt. So the future is not written. Mm-hmm. It's an open, it's there are multiple possibilities for the future.
Yeah.
And it's dependent on how you act now, which determines what kind of results you get in the future. So you can learn from the past and you can adapt.
Yeah.
So you're not tied into some kind of deterministic view of the mm-hmm. world.
Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. And it's, I guess like you say, it's that the wisdom that you've developed over time and that perspective to realise that knowing what you know now, if you knew then, you might have acted differently, but completely accepting that what you knew at the time was what you knew. So, of course, the actions and the results were as they were.
Yeah. I mean, I look back at my life and I've been very open about this. I've made so many mistakes, it's untrue. And I look back now and I bow down to all the mistakes, all the pratfalls, all the idiotic things I did. And I'm very grateful to that fool. Hugely grateful to that fool. But there was something wise in the sense of being willing and able to learn from them. You know, and it was suffering which was the motivating force for me finding this path.
Yeah.
Most definitely. So you can't reach the end of suffering without suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So you might as well accept yourself as you are, the limited human being that you are, with your skill sets and with your unskill sets.
Yeah.
And just move forward with a willingness to learn from unfolding experience.
Yeah. No, it makes sense.
And that's a lovely thing. Again, one of the many things I love about the Buddhist teaching is that it gives you so much power. Real, true personal power.
Yeah. Okay. No, it makes complete sense. So as a new meditator, or fairly new, I guess, sort of not into the double digits yet.
No, you haven't passed the 10 lifetimes.
No, not yet. No. With regards to sort of building a regular meditation routine, one of the things I've noticed, actually, is in terms of sort of the particular mood that I might experience during the day, I've found situations whereby, you know, I haven't been in a good mood or something's happened that sort of unsettled me a little bit. And actually, intellectually, I know that probably the best thing I could do is to meditate to sort of help explore those feelings, or, you know, get a sense of stillness or calm through the meditation practice. But because of the mood that I find myself in, I don't allow myself to do it.
Yeah.
And it's how you navigate that situation where you know you should do it because it will help, but because the mood you're in, you don't want to do it. Is it just that you have to sort of accept the mood you're in and allow it to pass so that you can then do something about it? Or do you have to sort of try and force yourself through it? I don't know what the right answer is in that situation.
Force is never a good idea.
Man up and meditate.
But no, I've been thinking about this recently, and I think that there is an aspect of us, maybe it's not entirely conscious, maybe it's an unconscious aspect of mind, that is actually trying to protect us. And that, no, you're not, you know, on one level, intellectually, you know, this is a really good idea. If I sit with it, I can examine it, I can experience the painfulness of it, experience any resistance that comes up and let it go. And mm-hmm. then I'll, in the absence of that conflict, I'll be lovely and calm.
Yeah.
And then there's another aspect of us which is saying, no, you're not doing that because that will be uncomfortable. And I think that there's a part of us which is just sort of deeply trained in to protect us. So if we have that knowledge, if we understand that the original idea was a really good idea,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
the wise choice, and we honor that unconscious or subconscious pattern of saying, no, you're not going to do that because I'm here to protect you, and therefore I can't allow that. We honour that and say, you've really helped me before. And there are times when, yeah, that was the right decision. But now we've got a new thing going on and I don't require you quite as much.
Yeah, yeah.
So you then, you have to, you just countermand the instruction. you say, yes. So by acknowledging it, you're not denying it. You're not fighting with your nature. Mm-hmm. You've accepted that you have this resistance, which is there intended to protect you, but that protection is not necessary in this instance.
Okay.
And then you go and sit.
Mm-hmm.
So there will be that sense of, oh. But at any time with meditation, it is a change of state. Any change of state, well, most changes of state come with some form of resistance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like when we decided we were going to do this recording, I'm sure there was part of you going, oh, no, are you kidding me? And yet here we are and we're doing it.
Yeah.
So it is possible, but the key is in fully mindfully acknowledging the reluctance, the resistance, the going, oh, and then just acknowledging what it is, how it's helped you in the past to avoid suffering,
mm-hmm.
but actually there's a higher part to us now which is saying, oh, no, I can actually sit with this.
Yeah.
And just being willing to go through the discomfort of that change of state.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. And in terms of the actual practice itself, from what I've, I guess, explored so far in Vipassana, insight meditation, is the idea of using the breath, following the breath as the anchor to meditate on. As someone gets more developed or more experienced, does that change at any point to using other techniques or methods or... Is that something that remains consistent regardless of the amount of time you've sort of practiced or explored? Are you always starting and going back to and using the breath as the anchor, or are there various methods that sort of come under the insight meditation path as well?
Very good question. The development is in, with Vipassana meditation, the development is in understanding. So you're still looking at the same basic components,
mm-hmm.
but it is a gradual development of understanding along with the development of the faculties of mindfulness, of concentration, of balanced energy, of faith, along with the investigation. So the emphasis does change. So when we first start meditating, we're really doing mindfulness of breathing, which is taking the breath as our primary focus, accepting and acknowledging that the untrained mind is like a little puppy that doesn't know what it's mm-hmm. doing and just pees everywhere. And so our mind goes off this way, it goes off that way, it chases this, it chases that. Monkey mind, you know.
Yeah.
Mixing my metaphors. And so using the breath as the anchor, as the reference point, you settle into allowing for the fact that the mind does wander. So you're not fighting it. You're working with the mind, you're not working against it, because thinking is normal,
mm-hmm.
and it's natural, and we don't want to make an argument out of, it can get very tangly when we start arguing with our own minds. So the idea is that it's all about acceptance, openness, receptivity, allowing for the fact that mindfulness will lapse, the mind will head off in whatever direction,
yeah,
and at some point, mindfulness returns, and at the point mindfulness returns or arises anew, is a better way of putting it, is when we become aware that we've been lost in whatever thoughts. And it's at that point it's realizing that nothing has gone wrong, that that's normal, it's ordinary, it's fine. And it's just a question of acknowledging where the mind's gone and reattending to the breathing process and following the breath.
And for a beginner, I guess that's probably a common pitfall for them to then find an opportunity to beat themselves up, tell themselves they're doing it wrong, and maybe even say that they're no good at this and they want to give up because of that, losing the focus. But actually what you're saying is you're turning it around and saying that when you realize that, actually that's a good thing, because at that point you've become mindful of the fact that you weren't there. So it's not a reason to beat yourself up, actually. It's an encouraging realization.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because it leads to a relaxation. It leads to approaching meditation with this real palpable sense of it's not about right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about trying to conform ourselves to an ideal model of what we think meditation should be. And I think that's where people start beating themselves up because they make a comparison
yep.
between that ideal mm. and what they've just witnessed. Whereas actually what they've just witnessed is far more interesting than trying to manipulate things to this ideal. So that's why faith is such an important part of meditation. It's just having the trust and the confidence to follow the instruction and believe the instruction rather than reinventing the practice. Because that's essentially what people do, is they dismiss the instruction and they reinvent it in their own image of what they think it should be, which is calm, peaceful,
yeah.
you know, and all those things. Whereas what they witness is, oh, I've just been off worrying, or there's anxiety, or there's frustration. And so it's learning to include all these things. And this is before we get onto Vipassana. This really is mindfulness whilst breathing,
you can call it.
You're developing the capacity, the faculty of mindfulness and the ability to investigate. So the idea is that these wanderings are an integral part of meditation. There's nothing actually which lies outside it. Mm-hmm. So even if a dog starts barking next door, that's part of the practice too, and you note the dog barking, and you note any reaction that arises to, you know, unpleasant feelings and a response to that experience. And you learn to acknowledge that, accept it, then bring the attention back. So you're noting things as you go.
Yeah.
Right? At the point at which it becomes Vipassana meditation is the point at which you're not bothered anymore about the fact that there's thinking. So when thinking arises, you note it, you bring the attention back. And because you're not fighting the practice, and because there's a maturity in terms of the faculties of mindfulness, concentration and the rest, you find that your attention stabilizes. It can rest with the breath far longer, because if thought arises, it just goes, oh, well, that's thinking. Yeah, and it acknowledges it immediately, and so there's no wandering. And so the attention remains on the breath for longer and longer periods of time, at which point, for it to be Vipassana meditation, the emphasis then is less about breathing, and it's more about just sitting in the naturalness of this moment, free of distraction,
mm-hmm.
and noting what comes up, noting sounds that arise, noting tactile sensations in the body, noting memory when it arises, or a thought, or a feeling, noting states of mind, happiness, anxiety, and factors of mind like the arising of concentration or the arising of distraction, whatever it might be. So you just rest and you just deepen the investigative side more than the concentration side.
And in situations where over time you become more practiced and experienced in terms of noting, where you're noting those thoughts or emotions that are not so good, maybe uncomfortable or painful, over time, is there sort of a, for want of a better word, a desensitization of them? Do they have less of an effect on you in terms of maybe a physical effect or even the emotional effect? Or is it just that it's the layer of resistance that was there before when you couldn't note and accept them goes away, so it's sort of diminished from that perspective, if it makes sense? I guess there's a few different elements to it, but just interested in terms of, from your experience over time, how that's changed.
Yeah, the wisdom, because you're looking at all these things again and again, the wisdom develops that it's the resistance which is the problem, because that's what magnifies. So it's not that you become desensitized to mm-hmm. it. Actually, you become a lot more sensitive to it.
Yeah.
But in a good way, meaning that you start to recognize it's when I cling to this. So if there's something that I don't like, in order to try to get rid of it, I have to think about it again. And if I think about it again, it means I get another uncomfortable feeling.
Yeah.
And then the desire to get rid of it becomes ever stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you get gripped in these,
yeah.
These cycles. And so as the wisdom develops that that's what's happening, what that means is, in a practical terms, is you just learn that the best thing to do is just to accept that this painful feeling is the result of past actions. I will just sit with it and allow it to pass, because transience is the key with this wisdom, is understanding that this too shall pass. This is a transient phenomenon. I know that from experience. All I have to do is rest and sit with this discomfort, and this discomfort will pass, rather than ramping it up again and again and tightening in, you know, creating this torque in the mind because you're trying to get rid of something. So that's what develops. So what happens is you, more and more, you just rest in the naturalness of life, allowing things to come and go. You're not denying them. You're not trying to deflect them. You're accepting life as it is, moment by moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that's what develops, really. And so really, it's this transcendent wisdom that understands what's unfolding and therefore doesn't engage in that resistance.
Okay, yeah, that makes complete sense. Yeah, yeah. And another thing that's just come to mind is, I guess when I first sort of started getting into mindfulness and meditation, the term like autopilot came up a lot. And I guess, you know, there's still a lot of people out there that are living their lives on what you could call autopilot and not truly awake to, you know, living life and experiencing it as fully as they could do or be. From that perspective, is there something about a greater depth of experience that you can get into from practicing meditation and mindfulness, as opposed to, again, coming back to more of an academic thing, I think it was something I read where you could almost have like the vertical axis and the horizontal axis, and you could live a long life on the horizontal axis, but really just at a surface level, which is maybe on autopilot, not really living or truly experiencing most of your life. But actually, you could live a shorter life on that horizontal axis, but with much more depth through being mindful, and the opposite to autopilot, by, you know, even an hour spent in mindfulness is sort of noticing and taking in each experience moment by moment, so that 1 hour is fully enriched, whereby, you know, someone on autopilot might drive for an hour and not even realize that they're in the car. So is that something that you really start to notice directly through experience, and does it feel, maybe since you've spent many years practicing this way, when you look back to maybe the earlier part of your life, does that feel like maybe it went quicker and now things sort of slow down as you get that depth, or does time still feel the same? Like, yeah, maybe it's a question about the perception of time when you really get into mindfulness.
Well, I mean, there's a lot there. My overarching response to that is that meditation, true meditation, which I would qualify as being an investigation into the true nature of reality, is the most profound thing that you can do as a human being. And that there are levels and levels of understanding which come from that, which are available to absolutely everyone, but that most people ignore. And it's not that they're necessarily living on autopilot, it's just they've got other concerns.
Okay. Yeah.
Perhaps. Now, there is that question of the absence of mindfulness. I think that even if you're driving the car and your mind is on other things, mindfulness is operating. Otherwise, you'd crash the car.
Yeah.
Right? But I've had many occasions where I've got home, you know, in the past from work, and I've got home and I've wondered how on earth I got home, because I just don't remember anything about the journey.
Yeah.
But there was a level of mindfulness which was causing you to recognize a junction when a junction sort of experience happened, and you adjusted your behavior, but yet the mind was preoccupied with worries and concerns and, you know, trying to make life right. And what you find with meditation is gradually that your levels of mindfulness increase and become dominant, and there is far greater clear comprehension of what's actually unfolding in your experience. And you are less preoccupied with things, because you realize all those preoccupations don't actually resolve the problem of suffering. You know that from experience, and that they just clutter the mind, and you much prefer an uncluttered mind. that uncluttered mind then starts noticing things that have been going on the whole time that you never notice.
Okay.
And so you get the depth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the question of time, I have to say that time just seems to be speeding up all the time. And especially more so than mindfulness, with the arising of concentration, and concentration is limiting the field of mindfulness to a small area and being absolutely focused on that small area to the exclusion of everything else. And we all love that. We love that. That's why we watch movies. It's why we listen to music. It's that pinpoint nature of the mind. We forget ourselves. We forget time. There's a close correlation between self-awareness and the awareness of passing time. And so when there is no self-awareness and there's no awareness of passing of time, you can spend an hour in meditation and it feels like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And if you do, say, 2 hours of meditation in the day, it's like 2 hours disappeared, just like that. But it's disappeared in a really sweet place. You're in a really lovely place and you enjoy being there. So time, the perception of time is very elastic. And for some meditators, especially, say, on retreat, and they're having a hard time, an hour can feel like a week.
Yeah.
And I've been there. And I just say, you have to persevere through those times. And there are other times when the concentration comes together, the mindfulness comes together, the investigation comes together, and there's this palpable sense of fulfillment with what you're doing, and time seems to just pass ever so quickly.
Yeah.
So it is very much related, it seems, the perception of the passing of time is related to self-consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense.
Self-awareness. And the more you feel separated from the world, the more time seems to drag.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember being at work, working in a bank many, many years ago, and just seeing the hands of the clock. And just the second hand would just seem to take forever to click to the next second.
Yeah. So I guess there's also that idea where people talk about sort of being in a state of flow and in the zone. And I guess you're fully, fully immersed, fully connected. So that's almost a meditative state in itself, isn't it? And when you're in that mode, I guess you don't even notice time. Time just goes really quickly because you're so preoccupied by everything moment to moment, whereas opposed to the situation you were describing where maybe you're in the bank and you're just clock watching, waiting to go home because you...
Well, I hated life.
We're disengaged there.
I hated my life.
It's sort of the opposite to that flow then.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, because there was so much self-concern. There was... Yeah, I hated my life. Looking back, I wonder why I ever worked there. But, I mean, again, looking back, I accept that it was what it was. I wasn't the brightest spark, just doing a job that was completely unsuited to my character. It's not a surprise that you're not going to really enjoy it. But I had to learn. I had to learn those lessons. And I'm so glad I did. So there is definitely that the more you are preoccupied with your own woes, your own troubles, the denser everything becomes. It's like everything has this gravitational pull, and you can't get out of that gravitational well particularly easily. And then when things are flowing, what's missing? Why is it that these athletes and sports people want to be in the flow? It's like because they're operating at their, not their maximum, but their optimum, and their optimum is where there's no self-concern. There's a total trust in their abilities, total trust in their development as, the development of them physically, emotionally, and in terms of their skill set. And they are just operating with spontaneity, with this total engagement, which is an natural... So it's not that they have created... It's not really that you create these moments of flow. It's rather that the moments of flow are what's left when at that time there is no resistance and there is no self-concern. So that's what meditation is bringing us to, which is our true nature, which is free, which is spontaneous.
Because I guess in that situation, I was just wondering whether how much of a role the mind's actually playing. Because it's almost like when the mind settles or the overthinking, the thoughts disappear, that's when you know, you're unable to perform that way. But maybe at a biological level, I was thinking, is the mind still playing some kind of function to enable them to do that? I guess it is, but it's not throwing in all the messy overthinking of thoughts because they're just having to react with instinct and respond in the moment.
There is no experience without mind.
Yeah.
Right. So experience is made up of the material and the mental. So in this moment, there is the apprehension and comprehension of shape and colour, of sound.
Mm-hmm.
There are perceptions arising in each moment. There are a whole set of mental functions that are going on in order for experience to occur. So there is always mind. It's always mind and body.
Yeah.
However, there are things going on in mind which just hamper us, and we call them hindrances.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you see like a tennis player who loses that flow, and the reason they lose that flow, I mean, often it's the moment of a match reaches that moment of definition. So someone is about to win, and suddenly self-concern arises. Whereas previously it was missing, and suddenly they become anxious, mm-hmm. and they lose the flow because of the arising of that self-consciousness.
Yeah.
So there are things that arise in mind which are not helpful. But that isn't to say that in the absence of those, that mind is not engaged in the flow. It absolutely is. There is only mind and body.
Yeah.
There is only materiality and mentality.
Yeah, yeah.
And both are operating at all times.
Yeah.
But they're just arising and passing away. It's not, nothing is fixed.
No. Yeah, I understand that. Yeah. How about in terms of the world today and how people view Buddhism? Because I guess there's been a huge rise in sort of mindfulness as such in the West now, hasn't there, with all of these apps coming out like Headspace and Calm and various ones. Do you have a view on how...
That's what we need. That's the one thing we haven't got, our own app.
Our own app, yeah. Do you have a view on how people perceive Buddhism versus mindfulness? Do you feel that maybe people don't understand it, they might view it, because I guess is the word religion as well the right label to apply to something like Buddhism in the same as it would be to Christianity or Hinduism, or would you see it more as a path and a way of practicing life and meditation as opposed to what might be perceived more traditionally as a religion? Or is it somewhere in the middle?
Well, it's always somewhere in the middle. Again, there's lots to that. I mean, taking the last point first, what the Buddha taught was not religion.
Mm-hmm.
He taught the way to realize freedom from suffering.
Yeah.
So it's not a belief system. You have to have faith, as we discussed before. You have to have faith to sit and meditate in the first place, to be open to the idea of a different description of reality than you've met with before.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not in itself taking a blind belief in something that you cannot yourself prove. Everything about the Buddha's teaching is open to investigation and for self-discovery.
Yeah.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. everything he taught, you can come to see directly for yourself. That's the beauty of the Buddha's teaching. So I think of it more of as the ultimate life training.
Okay, yeah.
It just explains exactly how life works and then gives you the tools to actually discover it for yourself. So nobody can do it for you. You can't just place your faith in somebody else and say, he'll save me. You have to work it out yourself, and you do that through following the Noble Eightfold Path. So it's a life training. How people view mindfulness, the development of mindfulness and the Buddha's teaching, it is finding the middle way with this, because for me, you can't divorce the practice of mindfulness from the philosophical underpinnings.
Mm-hmm.
If you do, then you're going to when you meditate, when you practice mindfulness, you're going to misinterpret what you're actually experiencing.
Yeah.
So that's why it's really important to have the guidance of somebody who's walked the path. Mm-hmm. That's why it's really important that you have to consider more than just mindfulness. Mindfulness is more, it's not a golden ticket to happiness. It's not like, well, if I practice mindfulness, I won't experience worry, I won't experience anxiety. No, you will.
Yeah.
Because they're habits and you do them. You can't just mm-hmm. turn them off. You've got to develop the wisdom, so you have to have it has to be couched in the complete teaching.
Yeah.
I like to say that the Buddha's teaching, it's not excessive in anything that it offers, and it's not lacking in anything either. It gives you everything that you need. It gives you the full toolkit that you need in order to overcome suffering. But there's more to it than just practicing mindfulness. And often what I hear being termed mindfulness is not actually mindfulness anyway. It's a form of concentration that people are developing. So there are all kinds of issues with it. And we could go down the route of questioning the commercializing of mm-hmm. spiritual practices, which is another area that I'm not comfortable with at all.
Yeah.
Because it changes the relationship. It means that it's that people are paying you for something. They become customers, and customers have rights. It becomes very tangly.
Yeah.
Whereas if you offer it freely, people mm-hmm. are forced, therefore, to have to confront issues rather than say, well, you can't. That makes me uncomfortable, and I've paid you. I'm not giving you money to make me feel uncomfortable. But on the other hand, if people are becoming more aware of what's going on in their minds, if they're becoming more aware through practicing mindfulness at whatever level, that's a good thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And if it is, as has been the case with us, that the gradual rise in popularity of mindfulness has meant that people have come to us to learn some mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been able to adapt their outlook to recognize, oh, there's more to this than just practicing mindfulness, and have embraced the Buddha's teaching.
Yeah.
And have therefore started walking the path, even if they didn't understand what Vipassana meditation is, even if they didn't understand Buddhism per se, they've nonetheless started, they got into it, they've started to realize the profundity of it, and they have become devoted to it. And going back to what we began with, you know, talking about this point where you start to recognize the teaching in your own direct experience.
Yeah, yeah.
And how that changes you, and how that sort of just brings this sense of profundity to what you're doing. And then those people are just naturally given over to the practice and following the way. And at no stage has it been imposed upon them. At no stage have they been compelled to believe anything.
Yes,
Which is one of the major flaws with other ways of looking at the world, that there's such an emphasis on trying to compel other people to agree
mm-hmm.
with you.
Yeah, but in Buddhism it's all self-validated and self-tested as you experience the unfolding of the path.
Yeah.
In your own direct experience.
Yeah, exactly that.
Yeah.
Now, it is the case that, especially in the East, it has been taken up as it's more religious, whereas some people are less interested in what you've just described and literally just want that panacea of, you know, paying homage to the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha,
mm-hmm.
of being generous towards the Sangha, as a way of ensuring their own future happiness, which is no bad thing, you know, but it goes no further than that for them, because maybe they've got other life goals or what have you.
Yeah.
But that's, to my mind, that's not really what the Buddha's teaching is. It's a small part of it, but really it is exactly as you describe. It is a path of self-discovery. in order to overcome suffering.
Were there ever any points during your own journey, if you like, where you had any major doubts with regards to whether the path was either right for you, or whether you were, I guess there isn't a right or wrong way, but maybe a doubt that you were following it fundamentally in the wrong direction or the wrong way, that you came to realise wasn't as it seemed or was, but you just found a different way to look at it or something?
I'd been inadvertently kind of woken up to a certain degree before I consciously started to walk the Buddhist path. So by the time I really consciously started looking at different ways, a certain degree of doubt had already been resolved. I knew there was more to life than met the eye,
mm-hmm.
and that was what was prompting the search. But the search itself does come out of a desire to be free of suffering, which does mean that there is a lot of doubt. There's a lot of doubt about life. There's a lot of doubt about oneself. And looking for answers.
Yeah.
And what I found was that I went through a period of time where I definitely tried different methods and different teachings, Hindu teachings, transpersonal development, reading Krishnamurti, tried a bit of Zen, tried a bit of Tibetan Buddhism, finally found Theravada Buddhism and the description of the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path and Vipassana meditation. It just clicked. Paticca Samuppada, condition-dependent origination. The way it was just presented to me clicked.
Yeah.
But I still had doubts about the best way forward. And one of the key issues for me was, how do I ensure I don't completely muck this up? How do I ensure the best possible chance of success? And I realized, and there was a moment of like comprehension, that I could become a monk. And I can tell you that was the weirdest sensation, because it was like something just went ka-clunk. And the fact that I am not a joiner, I'm non-conformist in my outlook in many ways.
Yeah.
And the idea of, in one sense, the idea of becoming a monk with all the discipline and the rules and, oh my goodness, and having to face social, you know, not knowing what people would think of me and all that kind of thing. That was all there, but then at the same time there was this ka-clunk. It was just like, oh no, that's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going to do. Because that's my best chance of following the Noble Eightfold Path without making too many mistakes.
And where people talk about like intuition, did that feel like it was a decision driven by intuition? Or maybe some people might talk about a higher calling, or it just felt right for your personality at a very sort of humanistic level?
It was the only way I could... This will sound so ridiculous, but it was like I met myself. If there had been some kind of decision taken before this lifetime, if there had been some kind of intention, some kind of desire to do something, and then that gets lost and buried under all this pile of stuff. There's a story of a messenger being sent out by the king to go and I think it's something like to go and give a message to another king or something, and he gets waylaid on the way there and completely forgets what the message was he was supposed to give.
Yeah.
And it was like, it was almost like that, a moment of clarity where I understood my life purpose.
Yeah.
If I can put it like that. Okay. It's like, yeah, I met myself on the road, you know. and something just clicked and it all just fell into place, really.
Yeah. And when you look back now, it still feels like it was completely the right thing to happen.
I don't know how it's possible for me to even describe the degree to which it was the right decision.
Yeah, yeah.
like I say, I look back on all the idiotic things I did, the mistakes, the pratfalls, the embarrassments. And I'm just so grateful for them. And not to say that I don't do stupid things now. I do. But now there's a completely different relationship to life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is impossible to describe the degree of the revolution in mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a completely different way of looking at life. I mean, now I love life, whereas before I hated it. I think it's But it's a disinterested love. It's like, yeah. I don't particularly want anything from it. I mean, one of the powers that it gives you is freedom from that self-centeredness and that need to reinforce the ego the whole mm-hmm. time. I literally don't care what people think of me anymore. And I don't mean that in a very sort of careless way. I mean that my sense of well-being is not dependent on you liking me.
Yeah.
And that gives you this... It's like when you have those kinds of desires, it's like you lose a bit of yourself. You lose what some people call the soul. It's like you get a hole in your in your soul. And when you finally realise that the true nature of life, you are no longer giving away that
mm-hmm.
and that part of yourself. So there is this sense of completeness and wholeness.
Liberation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's always renewing itself. Because life, you know, in the human realm, life's difficult. It's challenging. There are problems. There are difficulties. You know, and then there are these moments when there's just this sense of the true peace of reality, and you just sort of exist in that bliss for a while, and then you go back to work again.
So, from your standpoint now, if you try and look back at what was what you could describe your ego, can you see that now as truly and fully illusionary? Or is there an element of it that is tangible, or you do feel can still exist? Or is that sort of going into non-self, the ego doesn't exist, it was just an illusion, but some people who haven't developed themselves in that way attach to it and see it as not an illusion, actually as something real they have to defend and protect and control others to make sure that they don't harm it and etc.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a subtle point, because I still got all those things. I won't let you harm me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know how to, I say I know how to defend myself. That's not actually true. I should maybe do some mixed martial arts or something.
I was thinking more emotionally than physically.
Yeah.
But
No, because human beings being human beings, they will exploit any weakness.
Yeah.
And so I know how to stand my ground. Okay. I know I'm not you,
mm-hmm.
right? Okay, so to that degree, there is the arising of self-view.
Yeah.
That I know I'm me. I've got that personal history. I do not seek to, in that same way, I do not seek to defend it, because I know it is illusory.
Okay.
So I find it easier to say that the thingness of things is illusory. There are things, but they are empty of any inherent reality. And that's the great discovery. And so what that means is that you play the part, and you play the part spontaneously and fully, wholeheartedly, and yet at the same time you take none of it seriously.
Yeah, get it.
So you get the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
So you get to live out the human experience, the mm-hmm. human life, and I retain my humanity. You know, it's not the destruction of anything. It is the understanding of what it is. That's the difference.
Is it sort of similar to an actor playing a role in a movie and playing that role fully, but still remembering at the end of the day he's the actor, he's not really the character?
Yeah, you could, in a sense, you could. This is so tangly, but in a sense, subtleties. You can say it's like that. It's, and this is where I blow people's minds again, but. It is the universe waking up to realizing that it's being playing a part.
Okay.
We are the universe. We're not a separate ego, separate from the universe. Mm-hmm. It is all the play of It is all the cosmic dance. It's all the same thing, and yet it is able to take these different positions and different roles, and so we get to dance the dance, we get to play the play, and yet there is always the understanding that that's all it is. It's just the cosmic play revealing itself moment by moment, but it's not going anywhere. It's just always unfolding.
And if you've got that bigger picture or that perspective, then that allows you then to not take it too seriously or not cling or not attach, because you recognize it for really what it is, and you're not caught up in it as such, although you are dancing along with it.
Yes, and that's from the discovery that everything is empty.
Yeah.
Because there are some things that you do have to take really, really seriously.
Yeah.
But still, you know that they're empty.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I won't put up with any nonsense at this meditation center.
Yeah.
You know, so there are, you know, lines in the sand, and I have to be clear and direct, and I have to be that authority figure. But I also know that I'm none of those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but that's part of the dance too. So it's not being a sop, no. It's not being a doormat. It's like understanding what it is to be a human being, what it is to take responsibility, what it is to, yeah, all those things. And you, it's not that you comply with that. It is just that is what is spontaneously unfolding.
Yeah, yeah. No, it makes sense. It's almost to me then. It feels like where you've got different levels. You could say the level of the mundane or the super mundane, it's sort of at one level it matters, at another level it doesn't matter.
Mm.
But because you can't really mix the levels, you're having to play the role in the right way at the various level, recognizing the whole thing.
Yeah, because that allows for learning.
Yeah.
Because one of the joys of the great mystery is that it's not all solved. The problem of suffering is solved,
mm-hmm.
definitely. But if I want to make a recording of this conversation, I need to understand how things work.
Yeah.
You know, and we need to be able to make mistakes and get things wrong.
Yeah.
And so that's part of the joy. That's part of the mystery of life. See, it's not that you end up knowing everything about everything or anything like that. It's everything is still a mystery, and you still have to go through the process of learning about it. The difference is, you don't suffer because of the discomfort. So I didn't just walk into completely understanding how to be the spiritual director of this center.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know how to do it. That's the whole thing about promotion, isn't it? It's like you're not being promoted because you can do it.
Yeah.
You're being promoted because people believe that you have potential to do it.
Yeah.
And so I had to make all the mistakes,
mm-hmm.
even though, you know, I'd been told exactly what to do and not what not to do.
Yeah,
I still had
yeah.
to go through the process of learning.
Mm-hmm.
So making mistakes is still part of the joy of life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the ego,
the learning process.
And you see, this is where the ego is the problematic aspect, or what we're calling the ego is the problematic aspect. Because it's the ego is saying, no, I should know how to do this. If I was my ideal self, I wouldn't make these mistakes. And that's when you get into the comparison, and that's when you get into the suffering.
Yeah.
That's not there at all.
Yeah, that sort of rabbit hole to get lost in disappears because you sort of realise it's empty.
Yeah, but you can't, unfortunately, to understand what that means when it's empty is, yeah, we go back to again what we started with about the intellectual aspect. You have to discover what it means directly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what a lot of people do is, especially when it comes to non-duality teachings, it's like they're superimposing what they've heard, what somebody else has said, which
yeah.
is actually a form of blind belief. It's just taking what somebody else has said and superimposing it on reality. Whereas what you have to do is investigate,
mm-hmm.
explore, understand the true nature of conscious experience as it's unfolding, and then the truth of emptiness will reveal itself.
Yeah. No, I think that's really, really exciting. It gives you a different perspective on life. You almost see life as an experiment to just use as material or content to test and work through, like you say earlier. The highest goal is really to practice this and test it and realize that the benefits of the ending suffering through following the path and realizing it yourself. Yeah, so yeah. No, I'm looking forward to learning and experimenting.
Look, based on my experience, and hey, it's only my experience, you will never regret it.
The Orkana Trust is a registered charity which oversees the running of two Buddhist monasteries and a meditation centre. We provide instruction in the Buddha's path to enlightenment all the way from introductory workshops, regular meetings and retreats, to full-time monastic training. Anyone interested in finding out more can go to our website at Orkana, that's AUKANA.org.uk. In addition to these podcasts, we also have a House of Inner Tranquility YouTube channel with videos dealing with all aspects of the Buddha's teaching. And you can keep in touch via Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. If you have any questions you would like answered in future editions of this discussion show, then please post them on any of our social media accounts, or you can contact us directly by email from our website.